welcome to another episode of GT Radio Conversations with Tino. I have a great friend on the show tonight, a really smart guy, and a guy with some incredible stories to tell. Welcome, Ryan Froberg, to the show. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Tino. How are you?
Good. So let's talk a little bit about where you were born, you know, the environment you were in, and just a little bit about your formative years, you know, when you grew up.
All right. Well, I was born in Lansing, Michigan, 1977. My dad at the time was working as a line worker at Fisher Body Lansing in Lansing, Michigan. That's why we lived there. He wound up taking a sales job with a company called Inmont at the time that turned into United Technologies, turned into BASF. It's the same company that my grandfather actually worked at, and he became a salesperson. So we moved around a lot. So he got transferred out to California to work at the Van Nuys plant out there, and then we were there for 4 or 5 years and wound up getting transferred to the Wentzville, Missouri plant near St. Louis and spent 2 years there, and then wound up getting transferred to their corporate offices in Southfield, living in Michigan. So when I was younger and we lived in California, my grandfather was living in Tucson, retired, and so it was pretty easy for me to go over there every summer and kind of hang out with my grandpa. So because my dad was on the road a lot when I was really young, before I could start attending events with him and things like that, I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, and he was also in sales, so kind of a lot of different experiences with that. You know, I finally, you know, once I got a little bit older, you know, my dad and I, both huge Michigan State fans, have dodged a bullet today, thank God. But he used to take me to all the games, and I don't think I missed a single Michigan State football game at home from like 1986 through, you know, 1999. I think went to every single game.
13 years. That's amazing.
Yeah. And during those trips, we would drive up from Detroit to East Lansing. And, you know, one of the things that I got to do a lot was, you know, my dad was obviously doing work. He's a salesperson. So he was getting phone calls. He was one of the first people I can remember ever having a car phone, back in the days before you could take your cell phone with you. He had his whole car wired up, with a cell phone. So I got to listen in. They were always on speakerphone. So I always got to listen to his sales calls, which I think was, you know, really, really valuable, for me when I was younger.
Wow.
To learn, you know, to get that experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's invaluable. That's invaluable experience. So your grandfather was a pretty big influence on you too, right?
Yeah, huge influence. So when I was younger, I used to fly out there by myself at times, sometimes with my parents. Sometimes they'd leave me there and then go back home. But I got to, you know, spend a lot of time with my grandfather and my grandmother. My grandmother was, you know, a stay-at-home mom. Like I said, my grandfather was a, you know, high-level executive salesperson for Inmont. He actually got started selling paint, I believe, door-to-door during the Great Depression for houses, which I'm sure was a wonderful sales job. A lot of people wanting to repaint their house during the Great Depression, I'm sure. But he just, you know, always kind of instilled that, you know, critical thinking. You know, I can remember when I was really young wanting, you know, arguing with him about, you know, being able to stay up later because it's West Coast and, you know, I'm coming from the East Coast and I should be able to stay up later because it's the summer and I don't have to go to school and all this thing. And he, instead of just saying yes or no, he told me that I should give him a presentation the next day in the living room, to both him and my grandmother, Dorothy, and, you know, kind of like, I was doing work presentations basically when I was like six, you know, sitting in the living room telling him the pros and cons of why me staying up later would be good for everyone.
Yeah, and I mean, what's interesting about what you're talking about, and it's something that you and I discussed on the call, the pre-interview call, and a lot of great stuff come out of there, is that the formative years to the rest of your life, right?
Absolutely.
How it works.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think, you know, at the time when you're younger and you move around a lot, you know, my dad's job, you know, pushed him around to a lot of different places. You get to experience a lot of different cultures. I mean, I lived in Brea, California, when it was a bunch of iron horses up on the top of a hill. I remember going to class. I think, you know, my class was majority Hispanic and Filipino. I went to Missouri. It was a totally different environment with a totally different group of people. I was the outcast. I was this, you know, skater kid from, you know, Southern Cal. And, you know, here I am in, you know, farmland Missouri. You know, we lived in Chesterfield, which now is, you know, very built up. But back then, you know, I can remember cornfields right across the street. And I was weird
yeah.
for them. And then, mm-hmm. you know, going to Detroit, another big city, totally different environment as well. You know, it allowed me to experience a lot of different cultures, be around a lot of different things, you know, get uncomfortable quite a bit, which, you know, and later in life, helps out a lot, you know, because I, you know, nothing really surprised me.
Yeah. Yeah. You got a good base and you got exposed to a lot of things, and even those sales calls must've been pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listening to, you know, GM, I always laugh. I always tell my dad, he asked me questions about, you know, what's it like, you know, kind of working in a casino, especially when I was a casino host. He kept asking me, what's it like dealing with these people? And I said, it's a lot like when you were dealing with people at General Motors. You know, they want everything and they don't want to give you anything. So it's just about the same. You know, I mean, the other thing that was great is, you know, having a stay-at-home mom, you know, with me all the time. And, you know, her family's from West Virginia. My dad's family is from Detroit. There couldn't be any more opposite family dynamics there. But it was really nice to get that, you know, that diversity in my background to be able to, you know, I to this day, I still love chipped beef on toast. Some people call it something different. I won't say it on the radio, but, you know, like just, you know, flour, corned beef and toast, you know, with some salt and pepper, you know, meanwhile, you know, my grandfather,
visual,
would,
dude. Just...
my grandfather would take, yeah, my grandfather would take us out to Lely Steakhouse, you know, in Detroit or whatever. So it was,
yeah.
like, you know, it was really
yeah.
interesting to kind of experience both spectrums.
Yeah. My wife is from those areas. She was actually born in Lansing. So, I know
okay.
a little bit about it. You went to college for accounting, right?
Yes.
Right?
I graduated from high school with, you know, I won't say my grade point, but let's just say it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get a whole lot of letters from colleges. The ones that I did get were from some pretty low level MAC schools and some other places like that. I went ahead and took my ACT and got a, you know, 99.9 percentile on that, and started
wow.
getting letters from the Cornells and the Harvards and the whatnot. I wouldn't have got accepted at those because my grade point just wasn't up to snuff. But I wound up going to Michigan State. I will say that I did do all of the essays and all of the things to go to University of Michigan, just so I could get accepted. I did get accepted, and then I ripped up my acceptance letter in front of my friends. That were going to Michigan so that they could never use the whole you went to Michigan State because you couldn't get into Michigan argument with me. That's how much I love
yeah.
Michigan State sports. We get, you know, pretty competitive with each other, so they've never been able to use that argument against me.
Of course.
But, yeah,
I went into
accounting, but I think the interesting thing about my college career was I actually took more classes in postmodern theory, so a philosophy class that, you know, talked about, you know, the idea that everybody lives in a different reality and there's really not a true reality. It really interested me. Of course, there's no degree for postmodern theory at Michigan State, so I didn't get a degree in it. But having, you know, just as many credits in that, I think has been invaluable in our, you know, in our world, because, you know, part of the deal in marketing and casinos is you got to be able to put yourself in the reality of the player, or the reality of the customer, wherever they're going. Everybody doesn't see the same way, you know, so being able to see things a little bit differently or know that they're seeing things differently is really, really helpful. I got into college. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, as far as, you know, what classes I really wanted to go into. I think when I actually applied, I applied as an engineering student. But once I started at Michigan State, I kind of went into general business, and I had a professor, Dewey Ward, that was my accounting professor, one of the prerequisites for the business school. And he was a really, really neat guy. He's, you know, I always thought of accountants as being stiff and kind of, you know, boring. But he was not at all. He was, you know, extremely gregarious, you know, great personality. I was like, you know, he worked in the industry and he's like that. Maybe a lot of other people are like that. You know, plus it came really, you know, honestly easy to me. It was, you know, the numbers thing. I can remember when I was a kid playing RBI Baseball 1, which didn't keep stats, but I remember keeping the stats for the neighborhood and a whole season in a green bar paper book. That's how much of a stat nerd I was when I was a kid, you know, keeping
the baseball
stats for, you know, the original Nintendo.
Yeah.
I always kept score when I went to the baseball games with my dad, you know, and I would always be able to calculate somebody's batting average if they got a hit on their next hit based on what their current batting average was. So I always was able to do math kind of like backwards, you know, start with, you know,
the answer.
And go back to go back to figure out what
the
you
numbers.
Needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
now there wasn't an incident in your life on a balcony that pretty well changed everything for you. Can you describe a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, so, you know, my junior year of college, I moved out of the dorms and we were moving into a house. There was eight of us going to move into this house. And, of course, you know, it's pretty exciting. It's the first time you're kind of, you know, going from the dorms to the house is a whole nother, you know, going from high school to college is one step. And then, you know, moving into a house with, you know, only eight people instead of living, you know, two to a room and all that stuff and giving you the freedom of having a house. The first night that we moved into the house, the basement was flooded. So we wound up actually going to another house, which was a friend of a friend's. And my best friend was there from Central Michigan, and he was, you know, coming up to see our new house, and we were going to hang out. And we were up on the balcony of the second floor of this house and leaning up against the balcony. And, you know, my beer was gone, and I, you know, looked over at him, and I said, "Hey, you want me to get you a beer, Chris?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." And he gave me his cup, and I got up from the balcony, and apparently the landlord of the house allowed the kids that lived there to build their own balcony and gave them like a cut on their rent because of it. And they built the balcony by nailing in the 2x4s to the outside of the wood instead of using like screws and things that actually and brackets and things that actually make it safe.
Sure.
Happened was those nails just pulled right out of the boards. The board fell. He flipped over the back of the balcony. And it was about an 8-foot drop, which doesn't sound that bad, but it just was perfect that he landed and actually hit his head on the driveway. And he wound up passing away like four days later. And, you know, something like that happens to you at 20. I was cruising, you know, I thought, you know, life is easy. I'm not really studying that much in college, but I'm getting great grades because the difference between high school and college for me was, you know, homework in high school. I never did it. There's no homework at Michigan State. You know, it's like you either pass a test or you don't, and you either do the project or you don't. You know, like there's not really like, hey, do these 30 problems. But so everything was cruising, and then, you know, that happened, and, you know, God, man, things fell apart pretty fast that year. You know, I wound up, I think my grade point that year went from like a 3.75 overall to like, you know, down to like a 3.4 because I think I got like a 1.5 that semester or one, maybe even less than that. Like I failed a couple classes. Things were not good, you know, like really close group of friends in high school. We had about six of us that were really, really tight. And, you know, that something like that kind of gets in the way of things, you know, for the short term. You know, we're all really close again now, but, you know, people just go their own way. You know, people deal with grief in a different way. I didn't, you know, that was my thing is I didn't deal with grief, and that wound up kind of coming and biting me in the ass later on in my life. When I graduated from college,
you got through it and it kind of like changed your trajectory a little bit. Now you got into business in a very interesting way. You actually read a book, right?
Yeah, I got into the casino business because somebody told me that Whale Hunt in the Desert by Steve Sear was pretty funny. So I picked it up and I read it, you know, and my buddies and I were always, you know, my buddy Jay and I used to always talk about, like, you know, figuring out all the odds of poker and things like that. So I was always interested in gambling and the gambling industry and things, and I liked casinos. I'm not really a player, but I enjoy, like, the odds. Again, it's all about the math.
Sure.
And I got a book, you know, called Whale Hunt in the Desert from a friend. I read it. It's, you know, just cracked me up. I was dying laughing on half the stories. And I kind of decided at that point, like, you know, it'd be really cool to be a host. So it just so happened at that time I had quit my accounting career. Things didn't go well. Because of that, I didn't deal with the grief. I, you know, was having some severe anxiety issues, panic attacks, things like that. I even went like as much as like, I think 4.5 months without working at one point, when I was in my 20s, went through counseling, you know, met a counselor or whatever, kind of learned through that process that it was, one of the keys to, you know, getting over something like that is, being able to talk to someone who doesn't know you. And on top of that, being open and honest about what you're dealing with, you know, a lot of people hide that kind of stuff. They're ashamed. What I found out was, you know, even here at this property, there's 6 or 7 people that I know at Casino del Sol that have dealt with anxiety and panic attacks. You'd be shocked at how many people have to deal with it. So at that time I was like, you know, I quit accounting. I was, you know, bartending, and I loved bartending. I loved serving. It was a lot of fun, but you know, you need a career. So
yeah,
it just so happened that Desert Diamond in Tucson was having a job fair. I went over to the job fair. I had my resume all done professionally with cover letter, you know, wore a suit. I got there. I was the only person in a suit. I think I was the only person with a cover letter. I think I was the only person with a resume. I had never seen an Indian gaming job fair ever in my life. Most of the job fairs I went to had, you know, the Deloitte, the Accentures, the high-end financial, J.P. Morgan Chase, that kind of stuff. I'd never been to one like that. So I sat down, interviewed for a casino host job with Dolores Valenzuela, very, very, very wonderful person at Desert Diamond. She looked at my resume and she didn't see any casino experience. And she said, "You're not qualified to be a casino host." And I said, "What am I qualified to be?" And she said, "A players club representative." And I said, "Okay, I'll take it." And she said, "You don't know how much you don't want to know how much it pays." I said, "Absolutely not. I do not want to know how much it pays, because I will not take it if I know how much it pays."
That's great. And that's how it all started. You just got into
yeah.
it. What did you, what happened then? You started to get into it. What did you start to figure out? Because you had to figure all out on your own, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I got into the Players Club, and, you know, I watched our casino hosts, you know, do their thing at Desert Diamond. And, you know, at the time, the casino host position at that place was a lot like a lot of other places that I've talked to, you know, throughout my journey in gaming. I've talked to a lot of other people that run marketing departments and player development departments and things like that. And I don't think it was any different than a lot of places were. You know, the hosts ran around and talked to people, you know, and hugged people and said hello and got people coffee and took pictures of people that won jackpots. And they weren't salespeople, you know, they were service hosts. They were like slot hosts basically. And, you know, I knew I could do something different. You know, I knew that, you know, after reading that book, I'm like, I can make this company money. So I harassed the player development manager almost every day. Her name was Linda Nielsen, poor lady. I went into her office and I'm like, make me a casino host, make me a casino host, make me a casino host every day. And, at the time, you know, it was, you know, the middle of the, you know, Great Recession. And Desert Diamond, the salaried people their salaries were cut 10%. The hourly people had 10% less hours. And I told everybody, you know, as many people as I could, I said, if you make me a casino host, I will get everybody their 10% back. Finally, she made an opening. I applied. I got the job. I had to find all my own players. I was the first host there that didn't get their own book of business. So I didn't have anybody. I just had a floor report that I could run and ran out and got people. And, you know, when we were creating our host department here, me and Steve Neely and Tim Sutherland or whatever, you know, when we were talking about stuff, we always joke around about we're all, you know, pretty aggressive. And so I used to do little things, even like, you know, I take the best desk every time, the one closest to the door, so that I could cut everybody off to go get the biggest player. I do anything I could to get the biggest players. I built a huge list at Desert Diamond. I was doing as much revenue as my entire team, the rest of the team combined, every month. Huge players, and you know, it was a great place to work. You know, eventually, I kind of got to the point where I felt like I was kind of maxed out there. I couldn't really do much more as far as getting more players. They, you know, the lack of amenities, it's just really a gambling hall. Crosstown had a lot more. Reached out to Casino del Sol. They had an open executive host position. I interviewed with Steve Neely and Michael Glosser, who's now at Catalyst. And Michael Glosser called me maybe, you know, I don't know, 3 weeks after I interviewed with everybody and said, hey, you know, I got some good news and I got some bad news. He goes, the bad news is you're not going to be the executive host. And I thought, you know, how stupid is this guy? He's not going to make me an executive host. What's wrong with him? And that's what I was thinking in my head. And then he goes, no. He goes, the good news is you know, I think we're going to create a new department for you. And you're the guy that I think can create it. And it was a player services department that was basically there to assist the executive host. So to get rid of that service part so that they could really truly become salespeople, which is great because it's exactly what I saw when I was in the players club, which is watching these hosts at Desert Diamond walk around and not really be salespeople. So this was a way to build something from scratch and do it in a way that, you know, because it was great because nobody, I didn't have anybody around me to tell me that wasn't the way to do it. You know, I was able to just kind of build it the way that I felt like it, you know, myself and Michael, of course, and then later Steve Neely, the way we felt like it should be. And that was really great because, you know, we didn't have something, you know, we were able to mold it just from the ground up. So all of these things that I see other, you know, casinos struggle with because it's always been that way. Well, we didn't have that worry because it had never been. So it was really cool.
Now,
you know,
we had, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
We had quite a long discussion the other day about some of the things the casino business needs to get better at. And you had some pretty interesting views on that because obviously we talked about how it, you know, it's starting to become a real business after the crash, but even more now. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do they need to get better at and where, you know, you call it the day of reckoning. Where are we going?
Well, I think what casinos in general struggle with is this idea that somebody can't from the outside can't come in and be good. You know, I was an accountant, I was a finance manager, I was a financial analyst. I came into marketing in the casino world or whatever, and you know, not very many people would do what I did. You know, there was not very many people that would take a six-figure job in accounting, quit, go, you know, go bartend for a little bit and then take a $9.88 an hour job in a players club to work their way up. So I just think that we're missing out on so much talent that's out there that understands data better than casinos ever will, that understands financials. You know, these other companies have to, you know, when I was in automotive, it didn't matter what department you were in, you had to understand financials because our margins were, you know, somewhere between 4 and, you know, 7%. If we had a 7% margin, we were doing cartwheels. You know, and the line is so thin. You know, when I was finance manager, these are my friends and we're barely making payroll. So, you know, I mean, the stress that you're under every day, the competitive nature of the business is that you got to understand every little nook and cranny. You got to make every penny you can, and you got to save every penny you can without hurting revenue. I think that's the reckoning that casinos are going to get to is that it's no longer going to be, you know, in the pre-interview on the quote that you had on there, I used Lady Gaga as an example. You can't just have a Lady Gaga residency, because it's cool. You know, it's got to make money. That's an extreme example because most of us in this business are never going to have a Lady Gaga residency, but it goes for everything. I mean, if you're going to have a lounge act, and you're going to spend $1,000 on that lounge act, better make at least $1,001 or else, you know, eventually this golden goose is going to dry up, you know, and it's going to start becoming really competitive. And the people that just go out there and waste $1,000 on this and waste $2,000 on that and don't actually have data and analytics to support what they're doing, they're going to be gone. And it's just, you know, I see it all the time in a bunch of casinos I go to. I see it even in our own casino still today, where you know, we're not as good as we need to be. We're better than most, I think. I think there's some really good casinos out there. But to take the next step, we can't have minimum qualifications on jobs that say you need 7 years or 15 years casino experience, because there are great people that are out there in retail right now that are in super competitive markets that come into this market and blow it apart, you know, and kill everyone, because that's the nature of their business is, you know, if you're sitting at Bed Bath & Beyond, you know, 5 years ago, and you see Amazon out there, I mean, you're gonna be dead if you don't get good at it. You're not gonna win. You know, there's no winning in that environment. The only way that you can do it is with data and analytics and understanding the business from start to finish, not just understanding a casino, but understanding real marketing when it comes to things like that.
Yeah, they were in a bad situation, right? Bad from beyond, and they brought someone in from outside, right?
They brought somebody in, and it turns out that person's no longer there, and they're in a bad situation again. But you know, that person wound up taking another job. But that's the point. The point is that they started doing better, and then they started doing, and now they're not doing well again because they lost the talent. And that's the key, is getting people that have talent, not experience necessarily. You know, I always say, you know, people are like, you can't coach attitude. Well, you also can't coach talent. So if you got a good attitude and you got a lot of talent, but you don't have a whole lot of experience, to me, that's a pretty good employee. I'd much rather have somebody who has all the talent in the world and all the passion in the world with no experience than somebody with all the experience and no talent. I mean, why would you want somebody with experience that's not good?
And attitude on top of that, because they think they know what they're doing.
Exactly. I mean, you can have no experience and be great. You cannot have a terrible attitude and be great, and you cannot have no talent and be great. It's just not possible. So those, to me, talent and attitude are the two most important things. You know, the other thing that I think that we really need to do a better job of in marketing in casinos is really understanding what true incremental revenue is. You know, I see all the time when I go out there and people are like, we had this great event. We had 100 players come in and they all played $1,000. So we made $100,000. Well, no, you didn't. You know, how many of those people would have been on the floor anyways? How much free play did they redeem? How much incremental free play did they redeem that they would have normally not redeemed? All the different things that go in there. But really, truly understanding true incremental profit. These things need to be measured to that level. Like, we need to get to the point where, you know, these ideas, when somebody tells me they had a 400% ROI on an event, that's not real. Like, there's no way you had a 400% ROI on an event. A successful event in a casino, you know, can be, you know, 20 to 80% ROI with true incremental if you measure things as true incremental profit. You know, you have to be able to look at how many trips they were making before the event, how many trips did they make with the event, all the different things that might impact them, how many trips were made because of your continuity gifting, how many trips were made because you have a unique day, free play offer on Saturday, all these different things come in. The data is very complex. That's why it's so important that we go out and we find the talent that we need to in this industry. You know, one of the things I thought was really interesting about the conference up in Scottsdale, and it was a very small group of people that we had there, but we talked about casinos having to take that next step and pay for the talent. How are you going to compete in an environment for analysts when you've got Amazon down the street paying $250,000 a year with a bigger name, when you're posting analyst positions for $65,000? You're going to get a $65,000 analyst. You're not going to get anybody good.
Right.
You might as well not even open the position if you're going to do that, because you're just wasting your time, and you're going to get somebody that's going to actually do more damage to your company than help it.
Yeah, absolutely. What is your advice to the younger generation coming into the business? What do you tell them?
You know, I would tell them that, you know, that it's all about really, you know, learning on your own and finding true mentors that really can really push you. You know, I've had some really good ones throughout the years. I had, you know, Glenn Visengrad, was a player development manager at Desert Diamond, and kind of took my passion and cleaned it up a little bit and made me, you know, a really polished salesperson. Mike Tobias was over there. He had done a bunch of cruise ship stuff. He was in Tunica and Biloxi, you know, English guy, great, great mentor. You know, when I got over to, you know, Casino del Sol, you know, learning under Mike Losser, you know, PD guy from, you know, Atlantic City and Vegas, great, great experience. And then having Steve Neely come in with all of his database and advertising and marketing and entertainment experience was awesome. But it's really choosing who your mentors are. You know, like, you know, a lot of people I see look at people that have 30 years plus in the experience in the business, and they think, well, that should be my mentor because he probably knows the most. But I've found that that's not always true. You know, a lot of times the people that have been in the business for 30 years and bounced around in a lot of different places aren't any good. So why would you want to have a bad mentor? So it's really picking mentors and finding those people that really not only – and I guess that's the second part of that is they, you know, they also have to actually care. A lot of people say they care because that, you know, it's a good company line and it's a good way to keep your job. But then they don't show you that they actually care. They say they care about your development, but the reality is you can ask them till you're blue in the face for development. They won't give it to you. So finding people that will actually sit down and talk to you about the business and really like go back and forth. It can't be just a one-way street with this either. You know, the things that I appreciate about all those people is I was able to throw ideas at them and they were able to kind of tweak them with their experience. They knew that what I had was a good idea. They knew that it just needed to be tweaked a little bit because of compliance or because of the situation that we're in or whatever it might be. They were, you know, they taught me that the little intricacies of that where experience does matter. And that was invaluable. So that's what I would tell people that come into this business. The other thing that I would tell them is, you know, if you're going to do it, you know, go all in. You know, like, you know, the one thing about the death of my friend, I think, and when I finally dealt with it was, you know, in my life, I made the decision that, you know, I'm not going to half-ass anything anymore. When I go to do something, you know, I'm going to do it all the way. Like, there's not going to go in scared or, you know, tentative. I'm going to be me. I'm going to do it my way. And, you know, clearly I'm going to learn from people and I'm going to make mistakes along the way and things are going to, you know, and my way is not always the best way and I'm going to learn new ways to do things, but really just having that passion and know what you're doing is the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, passion is the key. Should we take some calls? We've got a lot of people
sure.
lined up here that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Okay, here we go. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. I have Ryan on the phone. Do you have a question for him?
What's going on, gentlemen?
How's it going? I know that voice.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. So do I.
So I don't really, you know, trying to figure out what do I ask Ryan? You know, I mean, I'm used to telling Ryan, not asking. No, I'm kidding. No, you know, first off, you know, thank you for the kind words. You know, we did a lot of fun stuff together, and you know, as far as people that, you know, really took advice to heart and made it apparent I wasn't wasting my time. You know, you're right there, and of all the people I've had as a member of my team in the past, you know, you're right there as one of the ones that absolutely rose to the top, and really enjoyed working together, becoming friends, and watching you grow, and you know, that was very rewarding for me as well. Through the process, I guess, you know, going to a question, you know, we spent a lot of time, you know, reading and practicing. Was there any of the books or any of the articles that I sent your way that you felt made an impact on you and would be worth recommending to someone else? And if so, why?
You know, I think I got something out of each and every one of them, but, you know, certainly the first one you gave me, you know, how to win friends and influence people, speaking of taking advice to heart. But, you know, again, I walked in, you know, pretty cocky and, you know, and thought, you know, very, very, very self-important. But that helped me to control that a little bit better. You know, I'm not going to lie. I'm still that way sometimes.
Really?
I try not to be. But from the business standpoint, you know, from the business standpoint, so far on a personal level, that probably was the most important, especially in my own, even in my own personal life, you know, like outside of work. But from a professional standpoint, I would honestly say it was the first one you had us read, which was Purple Cow, and just, you know, seeing it. You know, you always know that it's there. You know, you always know this idea that businesses that stand out will always do better. But to have it on paper and showing specific examples of it really, like, is very eye-opening when you start thinking about how businesses and marketers make their product look different than everybody else's and stand out, because that's in today's world. I think it's so important to stand out because there's so much information just being blasted at you every day that if you don't stand out, no, it's going to get lost. So I think that would probably be the book that I thought probably made the most impact on me.
Well, good deal.
It's always... You're talking about the Seth Godin book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of Seth Godin, I actually saw him at Shia Day in New York speak. And it was that's when he there was a book that he wrote, one of his first books, which was very, very popular. It was Permission Marketing. And it was completely fascinating and took the whole agency world by storm. And I saw him speak. He was an incredible speaker. Just incredible speaker.
I also think that also, you know, it's someone not in the casino world that can have a great influence if you will just listen to the principles. And it certainly does apply to our industry. And we can learn a lot from those guys. But anyway, I just want to call and, you know, congratulate you on your success. And, you know, it's been a pleasure and, you know, listen to the rest of the show offline, but, you know, thanks for everything you've done for me over the years.
Oh, no, thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure's all mine.
All right, guys.
Appreciate it. Thanks
all
for calling.
See you later, Steve.
Take care, buddy. Great guy.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah.
Great mentor. Anybody who works for him should absolutely listen to him.
Mm-hmm. Give me one sec. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. I have Ryan on the phone, Ryan Froberg. Do you have a question for him? Hello?
Is that me?
Yes,
Tino?
Yes, sir.
Oh, it's
That's
Michael.
You.
I'm
Who's
Oklahoma.
That?
How you doing?
Michael, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for calling
I got a couple quick questions for Ryan. First of all, how nervous were you at halftime today?
A little bit more nervous when it was 55-54 with, like, you know, 6.5 to go.
I thought he was going to blow his top. I really did. I thought Izzo's head was going to pop right off his body.
Yeah. Luckily, Cassius took over and a nice 10-0 run there. And then, you know, at least we didn't have to sweat it out at the end.
All right. Well, we were thinking about you when I was watching that 2-seed almost down. But congratulations on the victory.
Thank you.
That was a great game to watch. Anyways, and speaking of sports, I just kind of wanted to get your take real quick on how you think sports is going to impact not just, you know, Arizona and Del Sol, but, you know, Indian country in general.
You know, I think the idea that sports betting is going to change our industry a bunch is probably not going to happen. I just don't think there's enough money out there. And then on top of that, in single individually owned companies that are in individual markets, it puts us at a huge risk if we just open a sports book on our own. You know, let's not even talk about the idea of how do we get, you know, handicappers and people to actually pay attention to the spreads and all that stuff, you know? So if Tom Brady gets hurt right before the Super Bowl starts or whatever, like, who's going to change that spread right away? So I think we're going to have to outsource it because of, you know, those issues. And because of that, you're not going to get all of the money. And you have to outsource it to kind of alleviate the risk, you know. And in our market, you know, if we didn't and we just took bets and we kept all the money, and maybe we used somebody to set the lines and somebody to put the boards up and all that stuff. If U of A won the national championship one year when they were 100-1, we wouldn't. I mean, the sportsbook would be closed the next day because we wouldn't have any money left. So I think there's a lot of issues that individual companies are going to have problems with, because you don't have the region, you don't have the national ability to spread it out over all that risk over many different markets. We've done some, run some numbers on it, and we don't think it's gonna, it's really, like, it's sad. And this, again, talking back to something that was said earlier in the interview, when I worked in automotive, we picked up every penny on the floor, and here I am looking at this thing it's definitely got zeros in it. And I'm like, well, it's not really worth anybody's time because it's not worth that much money. Clearly, I think all of us would want to have that kind of money in our bank account. So it is significant in that respect. But I think generally where I think a lot of the advances in sports betting can happen is with technology and being able to do, like, in-game stuff and some, like, microtransaction stuff, I think could be really big. One of the things that I think going to some of these mobile game conferences has taught me, and, picking the brain of the people that run these mobile games, is those 99-cent, $4.99, $2.99 transactions. People are, like, more than happy to just $2.99, $2.99, $0.99 before they know it, they spend $1,000. So again, if you got a guy at a bar, it's very much like playing video poker. Is it going to be a run left? Is Steph Curry going to score more than 8 points this quarter? That kind of stuff could be really interesting on some tablets and mobile devices where you can put money in a bank and gamble it over time, and it becomes something else for somebody to do, and it becomes that sports book. It's not really your traditional sports betting, but I think with microtransactions, you could probably make a lot of money doing that if you could get the risk out of it, where people aren't, Steph Curry's not going to tank the second quarter to make a bunch of people money. Again, I'm not talking about people putting thousands of dollars on these, these things. I'm talking about, hundreds of dollars at the most, on these different little prop bets in game and things like that could be really interesting, especially in a locals market, because you do prop bets in a locals market, the risk is no longer there. Everybody's going to want to bet on the U of A game, kind of deal. So if it's, U of A is going to score 40 points or more this quarter, if even money's going on both sides, then, that's how we win and there's no risk. So I think those types of things could be really interesting in the long run. But again, the technology needs to get there. More importantly, the regulators need to get to the point where they allow that sort of thing.
Right. All right. Well, thanks. Great answer. I'll probably run into you guys next week. I'll see you guys later.
All right. We'll see you. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question for Mr. Ryan Froberg?
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Michael Glauser from Catalyst Marketing. How are you guys?
I'm good. How are you doing, Mike?
How are you doing?
Good. Like Steve, thanks for the kind words.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It's we talk pretty regularly, so we don't have a lot of questions, so to speak. But I do have a quick story about when Ryan came on to Del Sol, just to add to his jumping across. And he comes into my office and interviewing for this executive host spot we had open, and had a very analytical approach to his job as an executive host. And I just sat there thinking that, why is this guy a host? Is he coming, out with, things that you wish, if PD people had thought through, and a lot of them don't, a lot of, he had that mix of personality and analytics to back it up, to be successful at that job. But I remember just sitting there going, this is perfect for what we had wanted to accomplish with Del Sol. So, and I think, as they say, the rest is history. When once we had the idea to bring him on board, congrats on all the success you've had there.
Oh, no, thank you. I owe a lot of it to you, so thanks. Thanks for everything that you did when I got here.
Yeah. My pleasure, my pleasure. So what's been, you know, going from, you know, I understand starting in a position, I went back and I started my career full-time, even after doing some co-ops at Bally's in Atlantic City. My first full-time job was at the club as well. And my parents almost shot me, private school education, and, you know, I went and took a $7.95 an hour job after college instead of going into the beverage side as a manager or the hotel side as a manager. I wanted to get into marketing. So I kind of took the same kind of path where, hey, this is where I want to begin to get marketing side. But starting there, working your way up, you know, through the ranks and through all the positions, what's been the biggest adjustment that you feel you've had to make now that you're at the C-suite level?
You know, I would say there's probably two of them, I think, that are the craziest to me, and that's, you know, the politics, and not just from, you got two different types of politics. You've got your internal politics. You've got, you know, this employee made that other employee in some other department mad, and, you know, and some of them are laughable, and some of them are serious, and, you know, you got to deal with each one of them differently. But just the amount of time that takes up in my world is insane. And then, you know, and then on the tribal side, you know, the things that I was insulated from, you know, when Steve was sitting in my chair, just, you know, it gets in the way a lot of times of the things that could make the company more money or to make us more efficient or make us more successful, to make your employees better, you know, all the different things that, you know, that pop in. That the politics getting in the way of that is difficult. You know, every place has politics, but when you start getting into the C-suite, it is just like it's never ending. The second thing is probably just, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it or whatever, and excuse my French, but you're basically a whore. And everybody wants a piece of you. It's really hard to, like, you know, everybody wants to have dinner. Everybody wants to go to happy hour. Everybody wants to do this. Everybody wants you to go to this thing and this event and that event and all these different things around the city. And it's like, you like all these people. They're all really good people, and you want to go to all of them, especially when it's something that you're supporting one of their causes or something they care about. You know, you really like to go, but if you go to, you know, if you try and go to all of them, which, you know, at one point I did, you're going to kill yourself. And I was like, you know, I'm right back in where I was when I worked at Deloitte and Touche, and I'm working 140 hours a week. What am I doing? You know, like, I already went down. I don't want to deal with this. So it's really hard, you know. And then, you know, on top of that, you know, there's all these vendors out there that probably have great products. You know, and right now I'm looking at my phone and I've got, you know, I think 43 voicemails right now, and it's just from today. I'm not going to listen to those. If I listen to my voicemails, I'd be listening to them all day long. So that being said, for those of you that are listening that leave me voicemails on my desk phone, forget about it. You're not going to listen to. I delete them right away because there's not enough time. You know, there's just physically not enough time in the day for me to actually listen to them. So, like, things like that, like just the amount of time that's spent doing things that really aren't adding value to the business, you know, like whether it's the politics side or it's just the amount of distractions that come into play. And then having to balance, you know, even more than ever, having to balance that work life, you know, keeping your life as balanced as your work. And that, again, going back to the story about my friend and, you know, dealing with all the things I dealt with in accounting, what was one of the problems was, you know, my work-life balance was out of whack. And because I didn't grieve when I needed to, everything blew up in my face. So, learning that at a young age was really helpful because I just learned that I got to have a life. If I don't have a life, I'm not going to be happy. And if I'm not happy, I'm not a good worker.
Yep. Yeah. Very well said.
Awesome. Love it.
Great.
It is. I don't think anybody will ever accuse Ryan of not being open and honest. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Great. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care, buddy. Hello. Do you have a question for Ryan?
Aloha, it's Mike Hanoi. How's it going?
Good. How are you doing, Mike?
Good. Good. Good show so far, guys. Hey, you know, Ryan, you know, obviously we've had plenty of times to talk. What's something that I guess you get frustrated? You want to add that extra value, that extra revenue, and you can't seem to move the needle where you're at right now. And what do you think some of those hurdles are?
You know, certainly, you know, the first hurdle is always, you know, the talent of mining the data. It's just spread so thin these days, and I'm not talking about it from a gaming perspective. I'm talking about it from a business perspective. There's just not enough good business analysts out there to get the data in a way that you can use it and actually attack the other part of it. In our world, the one that's specific to us, to me, is, you know, I came from the Deloitte world where, like, everything was integrated. You know, like, I mean, you didn't have 18 logins. You had one login, you know, and that login was time and expense. It had your audit files in there. It had your company. It had access to the company that you were working on's files, everything. You know, everything was there. You know, it was all part of one system that was self-built in this, you know, self-built by Deloitte. And then you get into gaming and you've got, you know, IGT, but then you've got Atrient talking to IGT, but then you also have, you know, Agilisys and Infogenesis or whatever is your POS system. And they say it's an integration, but it's really not. You know, it's not really an integration. The data doesn't go to each place. So, you know, trying to build all of these different systems on top to sit on top of these systems. And there's a million of them out there, and all of them say they can do everything, but none of them can do anything. Or
yeah,
you know, I shouldn't say none of them can do anything.
$25,000 extra, right?
What's that?
They're all for $25,000 extra. Hey, we can do that for an extra $25,000
bucks. And then it doesn't really do it the way that really is helpful. So, you know, going back to something that Glosser said, I think that the thing that was nice about, you know, that person telling me that I didn't have enough experience to be a casino host was having to work every job in marketing from the ground up allowed me to, when we're building systems now with these vendors, to be able to put them in a format where people are going to want to, like, the people that are actually going to use them need it that way, because I know what they need, because I was sitting in their shoes at one point going, man, I wish I had this. Whereas a lot of these people that build a lot of these systems, like, you know, oh, I was a PD manager. Well, great, but you weren't a host. So what good are you? You know, like, you're not going to really have a whole lot of things that allow you to help a host work more efficiently. So, you know, I think that the systems problem is always going to be a problem. Just getting all the data merged together. You know, I mean, we've got data in our hotel system. We've got data in our food and beverage system. We've got data in our gaming system. And somebody is spending all that money, but trying to piece it together and say, how much is Mike spending is very difficult. And it goes back to what I said about the reckoning that's coming in gaming. As it gets more competitive and more competitive, you're going to have to make, like, food and beverage is no longer a loss leader at casinos. It's a profit generator. And as gaming revenue gets spread thinner and thinner, it's not that gaming revenue is going down. It's just more people are sharing it. And, you're going to have to start making more money on food and beverage. You're going to have to start making more money on entertainment. You're going to have to start making more money on everything else, selling cigars, whatever it might be. I don't care what it is. You're going to have to make more money. Well, to make more money and to market to people, you got to have data. And getting that data in a clear, concise format is extremely difficult.
Yeah, but that's a good point. It kind of leads right back into the, you know, and you see this obviously at the corporate levels, and some successful travel properties have done it, where you have that universal card element where it literally connects to everything and it does, you know, dump into the data warehouse, which is fantastic. But not everybody has the expenses. So, you know, you mentioned it before where you're talking to multiple vendors, you know, to really look at reliable people to create that, you know, solution that you're looking for. Are there ones that you've kind of identified as these guys are really cutting edge and are really going to make that difference for the reckoning?
You know, we'll see. I'm waiting for our audit report to come back from a company that I met at a non-gaming conference. That's a tech stack company that worked with Panera Bread and Domino's, Aruba, some other places. So, take that chance with somebody that's got tons of talent that doesn't have any gaming experience but understands marketing.
You see what happens.
Like what Steve said in his question, at the end of his question when he was talking about learning from people that are marketers and not just gaming marketers is really important, because they come at these problems from totally different angles that make the problem so much easier to solve.
That's a great point. I got one more question. You've had the benefit now on the air with Steve and Mike there, right? So now that you're, what are you adding? Not that they didn't do anything, wrong, but what are you now adding to their role that they helped set the form and now you get to add to it? What do you think you're adding to that position now?
Well, I think the biggest thing that they set the floor to be able to have a really solid foundation for player development and database. When they both got here, let's just say it wasn't very sophisticated. But it's taking that solid foundation, which is turning it into a very highly productive player development and database program, to taking it to a whole nother level is what I'm trying to do now, is that I've got that baseline. So how do we make it better than everyone? Now I feel like we're in the top percentile, but how do I make it better than everyone else's? How do I do things a little bit differently than other people? I think that some of the things that Steve always taught me the most was, just because nobody else does it doesn't mean it's not a good idea. There's a lot of things that we're going to try. A mistake is not something that you do wrong. Is not wrong unless you keep doing it after it's wrong. It's one of those things, like you can't get any better if you don't try new things. But you have to measure them immediately, and you have to be able to turn them off immediately if they're not working. So that's one thing I think I've been able to do. Since with what they built, and then being able to take that next step to be able to try all these new things.
Fantastic, sir. Glad to hear it. You guys are doing a great show, and you guys have a good night tonight.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Mike. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Sounds like we was at a baseball game or something.
Yeah, something like that.
See here. Yeah, hey, did you get that base? This is Tino Magnetta. I have Ryan on the phone. Do you have a question for him?
Hi, yes, I actually have two questions for you, Ryan. I've enjoyed listening to your talk so far. I just have a question. Sometimes I'm at odds with finance versus marketing when it comes to the environment of the casino. And you mentioned a lounge act for $1,000, and if they're not making $1,001, they're out. How do you quantify that $1,000?
So what we do basically is we go into the system, we look up the revenue at all the different areas that are around that lounge, necessarily. Gaming's pretty tough to judge with a lounge act necessarily, but one place where you can purely see how much impact the lounge act has is on alcohol sales at that lounge. Some of the things that we've done is we look at ticket counts, beverage sales at bars, beverage sales and cover charges, et cetera, the different things that you can attach to that directly. Clearly, if you had talking about what Michael had, if you had a universal card that everyone adopted, it'd be really easy to find out what that incremental profit was. But that's how we do our lounge acts, is we look at the revenue at the bars. The other thing that's nice every once in a while is you look at a day where, it's hard if you've been doing it forever. It's always difficult when you don't have a baseline, because you really don't know unless you take the risk and turn it off. But when you've not done it and you start it, it's pretty easy because you can see what it was before and you can see what it was after and minus out all the costs of everything that you're doing and see if it makes money. But like I said, I think the long-term strategy's got to be to get as much data collected on everyone as you can. So you can start to see what your players are, I shouldn't even say your players, because that's one thing that Tino and I talked about in the pre-interview was, you know, we got to stop talking about players. We've got to start talking about customers. You know, Steve Neely said it best or whatever to me one day. If you give me $100 in profit, I don't care if you stick it through a slot machine, put it in a hotel room, leave it on the counter, throw it on the floor, put it in the trash can and let me pick it out. It doesn't matter. You gave me $100, you know, you're worth $100. Whether you do it in gaming or in food and beverage, again, it's $100 in profit, not $100 in revenue. So everything has a different profit margin. But if you give me $100, you're worth $100. You're worth $100. You're worth $100. I think
systems are moving in that direction. I mean, generally, systems are moving in that direction. Although interfaces are not perfect, I think, as you alluded to earlier.
I mean, you see Vegas has moved their business model in that direction for sure, but they're horrible from a marketing standpoint in that direction. I mean, from a direct marketing standpoint, they're phenomenal when it comes to, you know, advertising and media and things like that. But, you know, I've never seen anybody bring out their, you know, M Life card at Hakkasan at Tiesto and put their table charges on their card. I've never seen that. So, they obviously don't have adoption of their loyalty program in their nightclub, which they should. You know, the people are spending enough money in there. They should be able to get, you know, figure out things. Now, and I know they do it through the guest lists and things like that. And it clearly is, you know, they clearly take care of those people that are spending lots of money. But it would be really nice in a smaller scale that's not as obvious when you have a huge bar with thousands of people at it. You don't know that there's somebody in there spending $1,000. You don't know that somebody's in there spending $600. You just see that, man, that bar was packed that night and we made a lot of money. But getting that group that's spending on things that aren't gaming, that data collected and using it, I think is going to be invaluable in the long run.
I agree. That's interesting.
Very well said.
One more question. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I cut you off?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. My next question, total shift in gears here regarding player development. What's your opinion on incentive program for hosts?
If you don't have one, you don't have player development. That's my opinion.
I like the way you think.
I think the idea of having a bunch of salespeople walk around and not being bonused is insane. I don't like going places that don't commission salespeople. I don't like spending money at places that don't commission their salespeople. I know they always say, oh, our salespeople aren't commissioned, so they're not pushy. Well, they're also not going to work, you know, and they're not going to help me if they're not commissioned, you know. Quite frankly, you know, at the end of my career as a casino host, we were not commissioned. You know, at the end, you get to the point where you don't answer that phone call because you don't care. Why should I answer a phone call? I'm already doing more than everybody else, so I'm not going to lose my job because I don't have production. So if I'm not going to lose my job because I didn't answer that phone call, why should I answer that phone call? Why shouldn't I just crack another beer and sit in the pool? Because that sounds like a lot better deal to me. If I'm getting commission on that person, I'm answering that phone call. You know, and on top of that, you know, I think it speaks to a larger problem in our industry. And I think this is just in business in general, is this upside down compensation model that's out there, that, you know, you've got a director of group sales, for example, at a tribal property making $165,000 a year, making the company maybe $1 million, maybe $1.5 million, maybe $2 million. And then you've got your best casino hosts making $50,000 a year, making the company $8 million a year. That doesn't make any sense. You know, it's completely backwards. I don't get it. Why would you do that? That means you're going to get one of your worst employees as your most important employee. Because again, speaking to the analyst problem of, you know, a Seattle casino paying $65,000 to an analyst in the backyard of Amazon, you get what you pay for. And so if you're not going to go after the most talent, and the only way you can go after the most talent in the host world is pay commission or pay bonus. And if you don't do that, then you might as well just take the whole department out and just do a better job of direct marketing, because that's what you have, is you have a mail program.
Right. I like the way you think. You know, we I've been in the business a long time, probably too long for your taste, but incentive programs have worked very well because I think human beings are content, you know, are basically lazy sometimes, and to motivate the host to not just call the same 15 people to come to the event, but to really, you know, branch out and develop new players. I think an incentive is really what's needed to make that work. And I'm glad to hear that you were very adamant about the way you attack that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Thanks so much. That's fantastic.
All right, guys. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. All right. Ryan, it's been a fantastic interview. A lot of great questions. And I really appreciate you being on the show and hope you, you'll be on the show again.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you, Tino. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this has been incredible. Thank you so much. And I love your views on the business. It's in line with pretty well what I've been thinking about too. So I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, Tino. And I will see everybody at NYGA in a couple of weeks.
Yep. See you there. Talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon, Tino. Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Great interview. Great guy. A lot of knowledge. And yeah, he's on the ball. Monday, March 25th, I have Wendy Carter. She's at Cache Creek. She has an amazing story, lots of experience. They're going to be doing some amazing stuff over there. And remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You just have to have time to listen. God bless and have a great evening.